You're listening to the Soccer Report Extra podcast with your hosts, Bobby McMahon and Owen O'Callaghan.
Welcome to the Soccer Report Extra podcast. I'm Bobby McMahon and joining me is Owen O'Callaghan and at the controls with producer Luke Crawford. This week on the podcast, we look back on a week that saw four teams qualify for the last eight of the Champions League, and we look forward to this weekend in the quarterfinals of the FA Cup. We also ask, is there any way to return the FA Cup to its former glory? But first off, Champions League, four teams sealed their spots in the last eight this week, and let's start off with Barcelona-Arsenal.
This game, probably the best that Arsenal could have hoped for, really. Obviously, the headlines dominated by the Van Persie sending off, which was ridiculous. But I think when you analyse the game and you break it down, yeah, they were in the game for pretty much the majority of it. But ultimately, just that relentlessness from Barcelona. The way that they had themselves set up to begin with, the pitch was made so narrow, so tight. And ultimately, if I'm being honest, I think it was just a moment where Arsenal just switched off, concentrating so hard for so long in order to keep toe-to-toe with Barca. And just in one split second, they just forget to keep intense concentration. And it was for the Xavi goal that got Barca back in front. And if you kind of break down the goal, ultimately it starts off with Xavi in his usual little role and knocks a ball to Iniesta and continues his run. And he starts running off the back of Jack Wilshere, but it's Diaby who's watching Xavi and he's just not thinking two steps ahead. And instead of going with him, he just stays where he is. Xavi, pretty much in Barcelona terms, ends up having acres of space and Iniesta slots him through. Eventually it comes through via little touch as well. And it's Sanya who's the last man who can spot it almost in slow motion happening, but by that stage it's too late. And Xavi knocks it into the net. And when you break that down and, you know, Arsenal somehow get it back to 1-1 despite not having a shot on target, and then for it to kind of crumble like that, I think that was probably the moment that's ultimately cost him the game.
The amazing thing is, I go back in my mind and think about this game. The thing that strikes me at the end is, when you get right down to it, Arsenal, with the last kick of the game, could have won this tie, which they had no right of being in. Even the 2-1 victory, you go back to Emirates, I think, yes, it was a great recovery. They scored two late goals, but Barcelona dominated large sections of that game as well, as they always seem to do. But the game at Nou Camp, very much dominated by Barcelona, pinned Arsenal back. I know Arsenal are sometimes criticised for their lack of finishing.
Yeah.
But I think you could criticise Barcelona for that as well. The number of times they were through, Almunia had won his better game like he did last year at Emirates in the first 10, 15, 20 minutes against Barcelona. Pretty much kept him in at that time. Kept him in this game again.
Yeah.
I think the number of one-on-one saves. But go back to this thing, at the end of the day, Arsenal could have still got away with this. And going through, and I think there would have been a massive sense of relief from every other team in the Champions League, because I don't see any way you can outplay this Barcelona team. You're going to have to set up, you're going to have to try and stifle them as much as you can, but you're going to have to need a large chunk of luck,
mm-hmm.
and you're going to have to need some very inspired defending, and in particular, some pretty inspired goalkeeping to be able to stymie them.
Yeah, and I think people are being a little bit unfair to Arsenal.
I think they're being totally unfair, to be honest.
I mean, you know, you have to, particularly with Wenger, and I think the Spanish press, you know, waxed lyrical about how Barca had reduced Arsenal to a pale imitation of themselves in how they approached this actual game. But ultimately, it's combat, right? So you do anything to win. Arsene Wenger, and which he should be applauded for, looked at their performance in the Nou Camp last year and said, let's not do that.
Okay, so Owen, if we're looking at the performance last year over the two legs, measure that out of 10. And then this year over the two legs, measure that out of 10. What do you think?
I think
10 being high, of course.
Yes, I think last year, Arsenal, yeah, well, they were still in the game after the first leg, but they had conceded two away goals. And the second leg, the way they were set up was very, very poor. You'd have to argue it was about 5 or 6. In comparison to this year, where they go to the Nou Camp with a victory, two goals in the bag. Barca, yes, scoring an away goal again, but they were with far greater chance of winning the overall tie this time around. So you have to look at about 7 or 8 out of 10. So surely there's been a swing of a number of points in their performances. The one thing that Wenger did do this time compared to last year was just alter his formation slightly. He was missing Alex Song.
Big miss.
Big, big gap in that midfield. He had Jack Wilshere and Diaby as the two holding midfielders. Last year he had one, and obviously Messi just absolutely moved around the pitch, eating up every little bit of extra space that he could find. This time, two holding midfielders were there for added protection. But ultimately, without Walcott wide right, they just could not even breathe in that midfield. It was so tight. They could not. And even the first goal came from Arsenal struggling to get the ball out of their own penalty area.
It's Fabregas' back heel.
And Fabregas' back heel. And they just pushed so high up the pitch. It was almost as if when Barcelona were on the attack, their whole 11 players went with the motion of the ball. They just took five or six giant strides forward.
Barcelona wave.
Yeah, it was relentless. And, you know, ultimately, you can't survive that pressure for 90 minutes. I don't care what people say, you can't. And also, when you add in that concentration, Barcelona having the ball so much for so long, and all you have to do is watch it. You have to just watch that ball zigzag across the pitch and guard your own territory. And trying to do that for 90 minutes,
it's exhausting.
It is mentally and
exhausting.
Physically.
Yeah.
And ultimately, for Arsenal to stay in with a really decent chance of winning the overall tie, even in the final minutes, that deserves a hell amount of praise for Wenger. Come on, talk properly.
Luke can edit that.
Luke can edit that bit out. Yeah. But I just think that Barcelona, this is really how we saw the tie going. And a little bit of inevitability about the whole thing. But we can't really just dismiss Arsenal's performances as being weak or phoning it in or altering their play and kind of being untrue to themselves. They did what they thought they needed to do in order to win the tie.
Or were able to do.
Were unable to do. Subsequently, you know, they didn't really get there. But I think credit in a certain amount has to go to Arsene Wenger.
And I'll finish this off with one comment I think has been missed in a lot of the discussions over this is how much of this has been self-inflicted by Arsenal as well, because they were in a position where they could have won their group and won the group very handily. They had the opportunity. They had multiple opportunities to win it. They didn't. They failed. They put them in a position, put themselves in a position where they were much more likely to draw Barcelona, and they did, and they paid the price for it. So now we're off to Ukraine. Shakhtar Donetsk winning 3-0 quite handily against Roma. Roma became the first Italian team to exit from the tournament. Probably not much as a surprise considering the 3-2 down from the first leg. But Roma's performance, what was your take on Roma? I know what my take was, but you go first.
Yeah, it's a strange one. It's one of those examples where how much do you really believe that you're in a position where you can win this game? Ended up 6-2 on aggregate. And obviously, we've spoken before about Donetsk at home and how strong they are. I think it was a little bit of a lack of self-belief from Roma. That even with Montella, who started off his career very brightly domestically, but making that step into Europe, very, very difficult circumstances to walk into and hope to sort of conjure up a miracle. One thing instantly you could pick up on, even from watching the highlights, was Felipe Mexes, once again, displaying his innate abilities in getting sent off.
Nutter.
Absolutely crazy, gentlemen. And yeah, again, you know, you're away from home, you need everything to go your way, and he does something stupid like that, and you know, your team are down to 10 men.
What could a son have done to deserve the treatment he got from that Roma team? Because everybody was having a go at him. They were treating him like a punchbag. Risa had a terrible tackle on him. Risa actually looked like he didn't mean it, and in terms of it was a late tackle, but he didn't seem to purposely pick on Serna, which was very different than the situation with Borriello, where he clearly just went after him and studied him.
Yeah,
and he was just getting walloped right, left, and centre.
It's kind of one of those things that
De Rossi, of course, that's you've talking about De Rossi's elbow.
Yeah, not to be too dismissive about it, but we've seen this before when I think clubs realise that perhaps not that ultimately a tie isn't going to go their way and swing in their favour, that they attempt to do other things in order to make the tie go in their favour. You know, cut out the other team's better players, do whatever it takes, Darwin-esque kind of theory and all that sort of stuff. But ultimately, how much does this come back? We'll probably widen out the discussion later on in the podcast. to talk about the general health of Italian football and what this kind of means, even though Roma domestically have endured a very, very turbulent season under Ranieri.
When are commentators going to realise that Francesco Totti hasn't got it anymore? And watching the Setanta feed, and they kept on flashing to the camera work, kept on flashing to Totti sitting there in the dugout, and kept on talking about when is Totti going to arrive in the game? When is Totti going to come into the game? Totti never arrived in the game. Totti was never put on the park because Totti is essentially finished. He might have one or two impressive little cameos left in him, but essentially he's 34 years old. He struggled with injuries, and I don't care if he's been the talisman for years and years. There is no sign he's got it anymore.
Yeah, I think there's a little bit of the Alex Del Piero kind of vibe to it. That there's a little bit of sadness attached to it. You know, there's one guy just, you know, gazing wistfully at the past, and the supporter is thinking that he can conjure up some more moments of magic from his youth. Ultimately, that rarely happens. And
especially at a level like the last 16 of the Champions League.
Yeah, and I think that Totti, you know, he hasn't even really hinted at anything like a renaissance, you know, like we've seen Premier League players like Giggs and Scholes do it on occasion, where they've gone on spells of a real, you know, revolution in their form, but not for
second wind, third wind, even in Giggs's case.
And obviously, they're a couple of years older than even than Totti. So I think it comes back to being a little bit of a lament, really, for them. That if you're looking to Totti on the bench for some sort of inspiration when you're trading the game so heavily as they were, kind of says more about Roma, really, that they don't have anyone there who's, I suppose, stepping up to fill that void that Totti has left and will leave. And ultimately that you're still kind of trying to clutch onto a decaying past in order to fulfill your dreams of what the future holds. Ultimately, I think this whole tie proves that the gulf that now exists between Italian football and the wider and general kind of environment of European football. But I think the conversation we will surely be having about the Spurs Milan game, we can just widen that out a little bit more. But ultimately, you now have Donetsk going through to the quarterfinals. How much do you think these guys will pose as a threat? Because their kind of home form we've touched on before, very, very impressive. But on their travels, do you still think they're very Eastern European in their way of being on the road?
The most interesting, and I think a lot is going to, the progress of Shakhtar is going to very much depend on who they draw. They have the potential, I think, to be a last four team. I think they have a potential down the road, if they can keep that team together, to be a very potent force in European football in the next few years. Number one, can they keep them together? Because some of these bigger teams in Europe are going to start looking at some of these players, because it is a very young team, especially up front. Yeah. It's a lot of talent there, a lot of Brazilian talent there. Some good goals. That William goal, the second goal, was a cracking goal. Beautiful goal. Jadson, I thought, was very, very impressive in the midfield. He had a super, super game. And you look at Adriano up front, he looks like a very mobile kind of striker, almost like a Louis Saha kind of player. But probably not as injury prone as Louis Saha. But back to the basic question, at some point then experience will catch up with them. They're pretty solid at the back, but they're also pretty young at the back as well. Shigurinsky is, I think he's only 24, 25. He's probably the elder statements. Rat in the left back is a good player. Serna is the inspirational player. Rogicki, the other centre half, is only 20, maybe 21, 22. So there's some youngsters in there. That'll eventually catch up with them, but it doesn't mean they can't learn and go on. They're a very exciting team. Lucescu, I was reading a piece in Champions magazine, apparently gives these team talks in Portuguese. Talk about planning.
That's a nice guy.
Talk about planning, though, because when he went to Shakhtar, he talked about what he saw, how he saw the team developing and what he could do to make them a better team. And he said he sat down with the ownership and said, what we've got to do is we've got to add flair to that traditional Ukrainian kind of hard work ethic, tough.
You know, that Lobanovsky, robotic, mechanical.
Yeah, fit, well-organised, all these kind of things, but we need some flair. So he made, I think he signed something like 13 or 14 Brazilian players up to now, but he made a, purposely went out to get Brazilian players. And he felt that if he was going to get Brazilian players and he was going to load up with them, the least he could do He's taught them in this, their own language. He went out and learned Portuguese, and he gives his team talks in Portuguese and then does Ukrainian team talks.
And something that obviously the players in that dressing room are warm to, because, you know, it's that old thing of almost a manager putting their protective arm around his players, that he'll do anything for their players. So ultimately, when the players go out and perform, well, they're performing for that guy on the touchline who's watching them, and he's been so supportive for them.
Yeah, and so you've got, you know, you've also got Eduardo, the ex-Arsenal player, and Fernandinho, who's gone back from injury. Teixeira, who's on the bench. So this is a team to watch. They've made great progress. Whether they'll go any further than the last eight, I guess we'll have to wait and find out, but certainly a team to watch in future years. On Wednesday in Germany, we saw Schalke be the first German team to progress. I'm wearing this one because I picked Valencia as being perhaps one of the surprise teams, and perhaps even the last four.
Yeah.
But they badly disappointed me. First leg, I thought they played very well. They should have got better than a 1-1 tie, and they should have got better, much better than a 3-1 loss against Schalke. But what do you make of the Schalke side?
It's a strange one. You know, we've seen it probably on occasions where you are, particularly, say, in domestic cups, where teams in the league are going through their problems, and they look at a cup run as this kind of beacon of potential success and a journey to go on, and one to look back on years to come and go, yeah, at least we got a decent cup run out of that season. And you look at Schalke, and they've been such an oddity in the Bundesliga that
for many years,
yes, and certainly not helped with Felix Magath at the helm, who has come in for unbridled criticisms for his transfer policies in the last 18 months or so. But the tie being balanced at 1-1, you felt that even with that away goal, I thought that Schalke would definitely score, but it was a question of, well, could they hold out at the other end? Valencia obviously doing very well in La Liga. And also Schalke missing Klaas-Jan Huntelaar, but they had Gavranovic, who came in and looked like...
Very lively, wasn't he?
Looked a bright spark, yeah, 21 years old and kind of no fear of the big occasion. And the game was slightly strange in that even heading into the last 10 minutes, it was still in the balance.
Even the last in injury time.
Yeah. Schalke
could have gone the other way.
Yeah, Schalke had a couple of chances, but they just couldn't convert them. But ultimately, once again, you look at the next stage, with Schalke being in the last eight of a Champions League, and any side who would get that draw would surely fancy their chances, as opposed to perhaps if Valencia got through to the quarterfinals, would other teams feel the same way? You know, having to head to Spain to a team who's currently the third best in their league. So it's an interesting one, I think, certainly for the looking further ahead to the greater and bigger picture of the Champions League's latter stages, I'm sure. And the other teams who will get into the quarterfinals would look at Schalke being there as a certainly a weak spot that they could maximise to their advantage.
Well, it's an interesting dynamic as well, I think, with Schalke just now, because you look at Borussia Dortmund, how well they've done. Obviously, they're Schalke's great rival. And you've got Dortmund getting all sorts of credit for their run in the Bundesliga and the fact that they're a very exciting team and a team that looks like they're going some places. And then you've had Schalke with this mediocre Bundesliga form. It's almost like the Champions League is their opportunity to get some headlines at least and try and push Borussia Dortmund off the front page. And they're very successful doing it against Valencia. Just to maybe talk about one player in particular, I thought who was absolutely outstanding for Schalke yesterday, was the goalkeeper Manuel Neuer.
I saw a game a number of weeks ago.
I think it was against Dortmund, wasn't it?
It was Dortmund. Yeah. It was a score to straw. And obviously, you know, you catch Neuer on occasions throughout the season, particularly in our job where it's highlight-based pretty much every day. But I watched the whole game, Schalke against Dortmund, and he was inspired. And what I did was I went onto Twitter and I just made a comment about, you know, I wonder how much United are willing to investigate how strong Neuer's proposed move to Bayern Munich is. Will they try to just sabotage that a little bit? And, you know, a guy who's kind of well up and well clued into Bundesliga news said, oh, the Munich thing is pretty much a done deal. But in recent weeks now, that momentum of a potential move to United still seems to be on the table. So I'm not sure if there's been rumblings in Germany about that. But certainly, the one thing you would say about Neuer is he's just such a commanding figure.
Schmeichel. Mini Schmeichel.
Yeah. I mean, big guy, but even more than that.
Just his whole presence, the body language.
The body language. And also a point that you mentioned yesterday was, even for defenders, they know that if you breach our security here, well, we are very much happy to let you try to get past this guy that we've got in reserve. So he's just a very, very imposing guy to have back there. And for Manchester United's future, I would look at them certainly. Certainly out of all the candidates that they've been linked to, I think that Neuer is the strongest out of all of them. I know that they're pretty keen on Stekelenburg, and he's got glowing praise and reviews from Van der Sar. But, I mean, once again in this game, the difference in goalkeepers, which I know is a point that you're keen to make.
Yes. Well, you look at goalkeepers have made the difference, certainly in this game. Valencia did not have the goalkeeping that that Schalke got. Mm. And I think the other thing, and this has been an old pain with me, is it's pained me for years and years to see the money that's spent on outfield players and teams don't seem to find the money for goalkeeper. And I go back to the Brian Clough story from years and years ago, and he signed Peter Shilton for £1 million, people thought he was crazy. And his point was, goalkeepers save goals, goal scorers score goals, so why shouldn't I look at them in the same way?
And it's, I mean, the whole thing of when you look at a team like Arsenal, who have had so many goalkeeping problems in recent years, and even Manchester United to a certain degree. I mean, they've never really spent big on any goalkeeper. They've obviously been stung a few times in the transfer market, trying to get cut price deals.
So I mean, Ferguson and Wenger have very much in common.
Yeah.
They've hit on a couple of good goalkeepers, but they've hit on a couple of dodgy ones as
well. Yeah, and it seems to be, you know, I'm not sure who the last really, really big goalkeeping transfer was that achieved anything like the figures that are quoted for the best outfield players.
Well, you go back as well, the number of times that teams have actually invested in young goalkeepers, and the young goalkeepers, Simonsen, who is now, I think is he still at Stoke?
I'd imagine
I'm not sure. Maybe he's moved on.
The next Peter Schmeichel, as he was quoted.
Yeah,
at the time.
He was the big guy at the time. You look at Scott Carson, you look at Ben Foster to some extent as well. Although Foster, I think, has got the chance to come back.
Yeah.
Robert Green.
Yeah, Paul Robinson as well.
Richard Wright.
Yeah.
Ipswich to Arsenal. You go through a lot of them and they just didn't be able to pan through. But I think this is probably a conversation for another day, but one of the other interesting moves I think will perhaps take place during the summer, Alan McGregor from Rangers. I think he'll find his way to the Premier League this year. The final Champions League match we're going to look at, Spurs and Milan. Spurs getting tremendous praise in the media this morning. Milan getting terrible criticism, or significant criticism, and Ibrahimovic coming in for more than his fair share of it. So let's start on the positives first. Let's look at Spurs. Only scored one goal over the two legs, but enough to get them through.
Yeah, and I think that despite the fact that in the second leg when they're at home and they very much were bossed by AC Milan for the vast majority of the game, you still have to look in the greater context of the tie that Milan were disappointing, whereas Spurs were solid, I suppose, is probably the potentially most flattering term that you can use to describe their performance. Milan, in the second leg, different in both personnel and the way they set themselves up. Missing Pirlo, so they brought Seedorf back and had him just sit in front of the defence, which was an interesting move. And subsequently what happened, it was very interesting that you heard Harry before the game talk about how you kind of wanted to bring the game to Spurs at White Hart Lane and go after them for the first 10-15 minutes. And what you found was, because Milan dictated the play, they were outnumbered in central midfield. So they couldn't get the ball wide because they were being strangled centrally. And you had guys like Boateng, who really was the kind of legs in that Milan midfield, have a certain large percentage of the ball. And he looked pretty bright in that first half. And actually, in actual fact, up until he was brought off as well. Ultimately for Milan, though, as you've alluded to in your intro, the one thing that you have to look at and is very, very questionable is them up top. I mean, once again, Ibrahimovic, flattering to deceive. I think in a big game, he failed to deliver. And he wasn't really helped out by Rubinho. Pato, obviously not given anything like enough time in the first leg. Second leg handed a start and he looked bright. He really was their biggest attacking threat. He came up with a number of attempts on targets that Gomez had to deal with. And was involved in arguably their greatest chance of that second leg, which was his little cut back to Robinho. Asu Okoto gets a tackle in, gets a little deflection on it, and then William Gallas is able to thump it off the line.
That was a big, big save, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a huge
moment. At that point in time as well.
Yeah, at that juncture of the game where Milan were just kind of coming in waves, and Spurs, you could see there's a little bit of confusion as the Spurs could combat it. Pato gets him around the back. Gomez kind of rushes out of his goal. He's left in low man's land. But some last-ditch defending kind of got them over that particular line. And last-ditch defending arguably was the way that Spurs kind of got through that second leg. Dawson was, again, quite dependable. And Sandro just sitting in front of that defence for the second consecutive European game. Very, very bright bonus and positive for Spurs.
But Redknapp playing Sandro again, he played quite deep. He was obviously there to stop Ibrahimovic getting in between the lines. Mm. But that almost caused some of their problems as well, because Modric, for a large part of the game, was playing against two, sometimes three midfield players, and really was completely outnumbered. Lennon stayed wide.
Yep.
Pienaar at the beginning stayed wide as well. So there's this massive gap in the middle of the park, and Modric was, to be fair, I think pretty much overrun.
Yeah, it was good to see him back, but at the same time, he wasn't...
A lot to ask of him.
It was a lot to ask, and it wasn't really the Luka Modric that we've come to appreciate so much this season.
Modric is a kind of player that always strikes me as one of the things that makes him so good. He is great in tight areas. Mm. He is the kind of player that almost seems to enjoy the tightness of the game, because he's quick feet,
yeah,
and he's inventiveness. Once you start giving him these large spaces, he seems to lose his effectiveness. You're asking him to play long balls there, where I think he's really much more effective in the tight confines in and around the penalty box. You want to get him close to the opposition penalty box. You don't want him operating 40, 50 yards up the park.
Yeah, and speaking of getting close to opposition penalty box, Spurs had Peter Crouch up front with Raphael van der Vaart in behind. And again, it was just this thing of, with Milan dictating play, they were able to just essentially throughout the game push Crouch further and further away from goal. So his sole purpose, in the first half, he was, you know, going to the back post and knocking down headers, as we've seen him do so often. But come the second half, he was just being made redundant as Milan just kept on getting higher and higher up the pitch, and suddenly he was being asked to win knockdowns pretty much at the centre circle.
Yeah.
And then obviously he was withdrawn later on in the game. But Van der Vaart going off with a little kind of recurrence of his injury, which isn't really good news for Spurs in their quest to maintain their hopes of Champions League qualification for next season domestically. But overall, I mean, you know, you have to look at how much did Milan genuinely offer the tie. I hinted before that their lack of urgency was a huge problem, that they didn't really have someone on the park. And you looked at the players that they do have.
There wasn't much coming off the bench either, was there?
No, there wasn't. And in kind of distinct... obviously, they had Merkel, who's a kind of a rising star. But, you know, you looked at the Spurs bench. You looked at guys like Defoe, Pavlyuchenko. Obviously, Bale came on as well. You looked at the Spurs bench in relation to the Milan bench, and there was certainly more to offer.
There's variety, at least. You go back, like I look at Spurs yesterday, Cioruca, I don't know if he's played a worse game, but Milan didn't have a wide player they could put on there that run at him.
Exactly.
There was nothing, there was no options wide. You look at what they're talking about next year, they're talking about Mexis signing. You'd think that's the end of Alessandro Nesta. Maybe the battle is finally going to be given up in terms of injury. Can they hold on to Thiago Silva? You go back over the years here, just go back to 2004, 2005, and see how Milan have done in the Champions League. 2004, 2005, lost, as everybody knows, runners-up to Liverpool, that famous final. Next year, lost to Barcelona in the semi-final. 06, 07, they won the tournament, beat Liverpool in the final. 07, 08, lost in the last 16 to Arsenal. 2-0 and 0-0. The second game, I think, was the 2-0, the one they lost. They lost at the San Siro. 2008, 2009, did not qualify. 2009, 2010, lost to Manchester United in the round of 16, 3-2 at home and 4-0 away. 2010, 2011, hat-trick of exits to English teams, lost to Spurs 1-0 and 0-0. So you go back, that's three games at the San Siro against English teams, haven't won any of them, in fact, lost all of them, and the best they got out of six games was two draws. That pretty much sums up, I think, where Italian football has gone the last few years.
There was a period, particularly in the mid to late 90s when there was this argument pushed all the time, and particularly in the English media, that English clubs didn't understand the European game. So that every time that you had a side on the cusp of making the grade, so to speak, in Europe, because really they didn't understand how the game worked there, they always failed when it mattered most. And you kind of had Manchester United's success in 1999, which was a little bit strange in the mix in there.
Yes.
And obviously the final was very strange in how it actually played out. But now what you see is that English style of play with, you know, this fast winger-based, creative midfielder-based.
But we see it in Germany as well, don't we?
Yes, we do.
And to some extent, we see it in Spain as well.
Yeah.
We don't see the physicality, but
no.
We certainly see the pace.
You see the pace, and you see that, you know, the leading sides, look at the leading sides.
Yeah. Whether the players
Spain.
Move quick or the ball moves quick, but it's all about pace.
Yeah, and that kind of patient build-up, even for the last 15, 20 minutes at White Hart Lane, Milan needed a goal to force extra time. And they seemed in... I'm not saying that, you know, the greatest strategy in the world is to lump a ball long, but certainly for the last 5 minutes, when you need a goal from somewhere, it's worth a punt to knock a long ball into the box and hope that a lucky bounce gets your way. Yeah. But they didn't even seem to be on that sort of wavelength. It was very, very ponderous, laborious, you know, long build-up. They seemed to have all day with the ball, and yet, you know,
I sense, and I've watched Milan a lot this year. If you take away the long ball to Ibrahimovic and getting Pato in the game, there's not very much there. They're badly missing a player like Pirlo who can create something from the middle of the park. But this long, kind of ponderous build up that Milan have, my sense is they do it not because it's a way of winning the game, it's the only way they can play.
Mm.
They haven't got the pace. I go back to a couple of years ago, and Gabriel Mercotti writing an article in the Times about the state of Italian football. I remember he mentioned that English commentators kind of looked at Italian football and said, well, they're not physical enough. And his comment was, actually, they're too physical. They're spending far too much time getting bulky midfield players who can win ball. They're almost going back to the English model from years ago.
Yeah.
They're looking for ball winners instead of creative forces, and they're not really bringing through enough pacey players that can change the tempo of a game and upset defences.
Mm-hmm.
So they're all becoming ingrained in this kind of midfield slog where they just go head to head and hope that eventually by winning the ball more, you'll be able to win the game.
Yeah, and there seems to be this kind of current trend, in recent years, even going back, firstly, before I make it kind of a bigger point, at the San Siro in the first game, you saw that AC Milan central midfield, which was built around power, athleticism, really fluid, flowing, passing movements. Wasn't really why those guys were on the pitch. But then subsequently, you look at the Italian game to begin with. Has there ever been, you know, wide players involved, even at a national level? I mean, it's always been very stringent.
Yeah. But you go back, let's go back to the Milan team from a few years ago, and you had Zambrotta coming. Maybe they didn't have traditional wide players, but they had guys
they had
at
bustling,
full,
kind
they
of
had full back players
yeah.
who could go forward. Zambrotta was a great example of that. Serginho, who they used to play down that left side, whether it was left back or even up front, he was the kind of player that could give them width as well.
Yeah.
Cafu, for years, gave them that width, so they got it from the fullbacks. They're not even getting it. The fullbacks did get forward against Spurs, but they're not a very effective fullbacks.
No. And
Jan Koloski's had his day.
Yeah, exactly. And you also have to look at, you know, the case of, you know, putting your fullbacks forward is grand, but the first point is, well, can you defend against what's coming your way?
Yeah.
And ultimately against Spurs, well, they couldn't really deal with obviously in the San Siro it was a quick counterattack that got Lennon wide right. And Crouch actually scoring the goal. So you mean ultimately you look at the state of Italian football and it's in a rag order.
So we're now down to one. We'll see next week whether Inter can do the comeback against Bayern, because they're the last Italian team standing. This weekend, we're down to the last eight of the FA Cup. First game, Birmingham-Bolton. Second game, we have on Saturday, Manchester United and Arsenal. Obviously, on the face of it, would be the marquee game. Then we're in Stoke and West Ham. Repeat of a game from just last week in the Premier League. Manchester City and Reading. Look at these games. We're down to the last eight of the FA Cup. But I'm haunted when I look at the games and look at the fixture list. I find it difficult to get excited, really excited about this, because I'm not quite sure what kind of lineups we're going to see.
It's interesting where a FA Cup falls on club's list of priorities at the moment. You go through that list, obviously United, Arsenal involved in a to and fro battle for the title, as well as United still being in the Champions League. You've got West Ham battling relegation, doing quite well at the moment. You've also got Birmingham involved in his relegation battle too. And you know, Reading in the Championship, still there or thereabouts in their kind of quest to get through into that playoff spot if they could. It's, you know, pretty much a long shot at the moment, but they still could come in for a bit of a last stand. So it's interesting to see how much of the romance is left in the cup. Ultimately, do the FA have to come in here and look at a bigger picture? And I mean, if you're in a case of Manchester United against Arsenal, as you said, the marquee game on Saturday, and the lineups are announced, then you're going to be looking at Darren Gibson playing centre midfield for United, along with John O'Shea, centre back. The two De Silvas on either flank. Gabriel Obertan, maybe a Bebe might seem involved against an Arsenal team.
You're very confident.
Against an Arsenal team that also, Arsenal. You know, who knows what the Arsenal lineup would be?
Who's left standing?
Who's left standing exactly, and who's not in the treatment room? And if that is your big fixture to look forward to an FA Cup weekend, surely that reflects in a Carling Cup way in what could arguably be called the greatest cup competition in the world.
It continues to be called the greatest cup competition in the world, but to me the reality is you've got a dynamic that works against it, because you've got this behemoth called the Premier League, which generates mountains of money. Obviously, that's where every team wants to be. The top teams want to be there so they can get into the Champions League, so they can make more money. The teams like maybe a Reading in the Championship, the only Championship team left, they're looking at potentially, yes, it's maybe a long shot, but if they can get in the promotion playoff race, they get into the playoffs, suddenly they've got the potential. They could be sitting there with £60 million, like $100 million payoff, and you're expecting them to look at the FA Cup for a bit of glory. Now, we all want to win cups. It's, you know, silverware's great, but the reality, the dynamic is forcing teams away from the FA Cup into other interests around the league. How can you reinvigorate the FA Cup, Owen?
It's a difficult one, because it's that tournament that you don't, I suppose, want to meddle with too much because of its history. So you don't want to ultimately come in and turn the cup commercial for the sake of turning it commercial. That's maybe it's the last remaining facet of nobility remaining in the English game, that people look at the cup and go, well, let's do it for the cup because, well, it's the FA Cup. It's romantic and, you know, smaller teams can succeed. A David versus Goliath sort of argument. Ultimately, in a very, as you've touched on, financially ridden Premier League and English game in general, the FA Cup is almost kind of a breath of fresh air. We've seen the romantic stories that have gone on. I've mentioned romance about 40 times. I apologise to listeners. You're getting a little bit,
this podcast brought to you by Harlequin.
But moving on, there has been teams in the Cup this season who have, you know, hinted at very, very nice stories, you know, nice football stories that we don't see enough of anymore. Ultimately, in a bigger picture, how do you change it? Do they want to change it? I mean, you know.
Well, I think if you don't change it, eventually, no matter how much we hear on TV about the romance and how big the tournament is and how famous it is, it will just evolve into something that is no longer relevant at any level. It will become just another Carling Cup.
But I think the argument can be made that if you don't have something that's different and unique, well, then everything just fades into everything else and it becomes just a kind of a massive vagueness and vanilla flavour.
Yeah, I think that I've said a number of occasions that knockout tournaments are the lifeblood of soccer, because the knockout tournament gives you the surprises. Very rarely have we ever seen a surprise team win the league, and certainly not in this era of big money. It just doesn't happen
anymore.
And it'll
be a long time before it happens again.
And it will. So you've got to, the cup and the knockout kind of format, it reinvigorates us, makes us believe that anything is possible. And this is my hobby horse, and I've been on it for a while, and I've been knocked down a few times, but until the FA turn round and give a Champions League spot to the FA Cup winner, the tournament will continue to grow into irrelevance.
Is that a very risky strategy, though? Here's a devil's advocate, ridiculous example.
Portsmouth
being one, but say, take the FA Cup this year, that you have a situation whereby a final exists between Arsenal and Reading. but Arsenal already got Champions League qualification. So Arsenal beat Reading in the FA Cup, but because they already have Champions League qualification in the bag due to their position in the league, qualification to the Champions League falls for Reading.
Only the winner. Only the winner gets Champions League. If it's a runner-up, you go into the Europa League like before, but only the winner gets it, because you've got to go right to the end to make sure that teams are trying to make sure as much as possible that teams play their best teams.
And what happens, that Champions League berth that's was
goes,
made
goes
available.
Back to the Premier League.
Okay. It's an interesting proposal. Yeah.
Because the other argument that's put forward is it'll damage England's coefficient and it might put places at risk. And absolutely, you go in and look at the coefficient just now and that is an absolute red herring. There is nothing to do. England are so far ahead in terms of coefficient, there is no risk for Champions League spots being lost. And in fact, the FA are in a position just now where they could put a trial period in. They could say, we're going to do this for 2 or 3 years. And even if it was a Reading that won the FA Cup and got knocked out in the Champions League at the group stage or even the qualifying stage, whatever it is, it wouldn't damage the coefficient to the extent that it would put these spots in jeopardy.
And we have seen this before, and that's even it can be argued that the FA Cup, you know, was fading and essentially kind of began its descent into this fourth priority in clubs' lists now, when Manchester United went to the Club World Cup, and there was that kind of decision.
And that really worked out for them, didn't it?
Didn't it?
They worked out for the FIFA as well.
A very, very nice trip to South America on that occasion they got. But when there's a kind of a decision to be made whether you stay or you go, bigger picture, obviously there was talk of government being involved in that decision, but ultimately...
It's always another good sign, isn't it?
Yeah, we've talked about how much the club or the Cup's history is worth. But ultimately, in the cold light of day, sometimes when there's a decision to be made to look bigger picture, well, that kind of history and romance and the love of the game that goes along with it is kind of quickly forgotten about when United kind of so quickly headed to South America instead of deciding to play in that FA Cup campaign. Yeah.
So let's finish off. We've got four games here. Let's go for a little run-through predictions. I've written mine down, which you're not seeing.
Okay.
I'm hiding them at the moment. Only producer Luke can actually see. He's got your poker cam going at the moment. But let's go through them. Birmingham-Bolton.
Bolton to win 3-1.
Ooh. Manchester United-Arsenal.
Replay.
And then who wins?
Score, draw, and replay where United will beat Arsenal.
Okay. Stoke-West Ham.
West Ham to win.
Manchester City, Reading.
City to win, but it'll be tight.
Okay, well, here's mine because I wrote them down before you. Bolton to win, Manchester United to win first time, Stoke to win, and Manchester City to win. So we've got one game we disagree on. Check back next week and we'll find out who got them right and who screwed up again. That's all we have time for this week. I'm Bobby McMahon, and on behalf of Owen O'Callaghan and producer Luke Crawford, thank you for allowing us to be part of your day. And until next week, goodbye.
Thank you for listening to the Soccer Report Extra podcast. For more great soccer news, highlights, and analysis, watch the Fox Soccer Report every night at 10 p.m. Eastern on Fox Soccer and Fox Sports World Canada. And be sure to check out SoccerReportExtra.com daily for previews, opinions, and reviews. Music for this podcast provided by SoundJay.com.